So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Review Man.
Yoko's on a kick out of Hogan's laptop.
I can't believe it. Never before has anybody done that.
Hogan. The photographer. They got to get that photographer down. He shouldn't be up on the apron. That's a dangerous place to be.
Well, these pictures are so good.
Oh, my God.
What was that?
His camera exploded.
What the?
Not in Hogan's face. His camera exploded in Hogan's face. Yokozuna drops a leg on Hogan. Yokozuna.
One,
the leg hook.
Two.
Yokozuna.
Hey, we got a new champion. We got a new champion.
What the hell happened?
Obviously, his camera exploded.
Boy, the headlines in the papers in Japan are going to be full of pictures
Hogan's
of Yokozuna.
Hogan's eyes. Hogan's sight has been impaired from that explosion. Oh, no.
Hogan doesn't know where he's at. He's blind. Oh, I know what he's going to do.
Yokozuna wants to add insult to injury.
He wants to end Hogan's career.
He wants to kill Hulkamania.
He's going to squash Hulkamania. Yokozuna has squashed Hulkamania.
Hulkamania is dead.
I've got your picture. I've got your picture. I'd like a million of your aura myself. I want a doctor to take a picture so I can look at you from inside as well. You got me turning up and turning down. I'm turning in, I'm turning red, I'm turning Japanese. I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so. Turning Japanese, I think I'm turning Japanese, I really think so.
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock, and I'm with Wei Ting. How are you doing this afternoon, this morning, Wei?
Doing great, man.
Awesome. You are very color coordinated today. Black and green. It's a nice combination.
Okay. Thank you.
That's all I'm just trying to convey your look to all the people out there.
Thanks, man. Thank you. I appreciate that.
People enjoy what you wear now on Monday nights, Tuesday mornings.
Who's people?
Yeah, people that are now watching you on Review or Raw. Are you more conscientious now of what you wear when you come in?
Yeah, if I'm going to be on camera. Sometimes, yeah. Not all the time.
What's your go-to shirt?
I don't have one.
You wear that blue one.
Blue one?
You have a blue-looking shirt.
This one?
No, not that one. The darker blue.
Chambray? My chambray shirt?
Chambray. Is that what that is?
I think that's what they call.
Oh, God.
What's the
You've been listening to Josh Matthews fashion podcast, haven't you?
I didn't know he had one.
Oh, I'm sure they've had a whole hour dedicated to chambrays.
Chambray. What is the blue shirt that you're referring to?
It's like a dark blue shirt that you wear numerous times. It's got like some patterns on it.
My dark blue shirt?
It's a dark blue.
This
like,
one?
No. Like a shirt that you button up.
Dark blue.
You wore it on the weekend, or last week at some time, because we joked when you walked in with your glasses on.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm talking about.
I think that's more of a check. It's more of a like a check pattern.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mr. Aficionado.
Not even dark blue.
In the fashion world. It's blue.
It's blue.
That's how I categorize it. This? Green.
This is the worst podcast start we perhaps have ever done.
No, it's the best, actually. I think we're doing a tremendous job.
This is as stupid as a fashion podcast. No offense.
Oh, my God.
Come on. You got to see. This is a visual thing, what we're talking about. It's like talking about like pro wrestling. It's stupid.
We should have had this conversation on Monday night and not Wednesday. We've got to separate our conversations from visual ones versus audio ones.
So we'll only talk about sounds. What's your favorite sound, man? You got a favorite sound at the moment? You like a sound that like you know what a sound I like is like a sipping sound. Like that is great. Love that.
I wonder why we do that just naturally. It's a natural reaction.
Well, when you're sipping, you're breathing in. So it's almost like you're holding your breath. So
swallow.
And you release. It's an exhale more than anything. I feel it's more controlled than that. I feel people just, they kind of just let themselves go wild after sipping something.
It's not the same, though, if you, like, sip and then go, like, you just breathe out without making a sound. The more sounds you make, the better it feels.
Do you... I've recently gotten back into using my sleep app, which records my sounds that I make.
It's so weird.
In the evening. It's fun.
But it's so awesome.
It's like, usually in the morning I wake up and there are 11 sounds I've made in my sleep.
And you listen to them?
Yeah. Usually some of them are like this, like knocking sound, which I feel are just like, I hope it's not my teeth, because it's like, it's loud enough that I'm like, Christ, I'm doing some damage.
Do you ever talk?
Occasionally I talk in my sleep. I told you about this when we were in Montreal.
Do you have your recording from last night?
No, I don't.
Yeah, you do.
No.
Yeah, you do. Why wouldn't you?
I don't have any recordings from last night.
What was the last recording that you have on your phone? Let's just give a sample. We're talking about sounds here. This is an audio podcast. Let's give our audience some sounds.
Well, I delete them in the morning because they're all WAV files and they take up ridiculous amounts of space in my phone, so they delete quickly.
Fine.
But I told you when we were in Montreal, I was like, wait, just so you're aware, we did have to share a room. I was like, wait, I talk in my sleep. And I've been doing it a lot of late, so don't be alarmed.
Didn't notice at all.
I didn't record at all when I was in Montreal, so I don't know if I did or not. I gave you fair warning.
I'm also sort of a deeper sleeper, so you'll be fine. You're fine. What do you say when you're asleep?
I'm trying to remember the last one I recorded. Like, they never make any sense, obviously. You're never putting together coherent sentences when you're unconscious.
What words?
I can't remember. I think a week or two ago, it was like 3 seconds where I was talking about a key, finding a key.
Finding a key.
I hate those responses when you explain what you're like. That makes no sense. No shit. Like, if I were to describe a dream I was having, same reaction people give.
No,
it's
no,
like,
no.
That makes, you dreamt about a unicorn that was fighting crime? That's so stupid, man. That's, why wouldn't you dream of something better?
I didn't say any of those things.
You had a reaction.
That was
you
not
had a
even...
look. You're like, a key.
Well, what the fuck am I supposed to say? Like, because it's just a random thing. If you had mentioned something that would actually make sense, there's nothing you could say that would make sense. You know, because
what if you did say something like really astute, like,
okay, what
the upcoming Republican primary is going to be a huge referendum on the Republican Party and what kind of steps they're going to take moving forward for the election in 2016.
If you said all that while you're asleep, I would really be scared. I'd not just be surprised; I'd be scared. But I gave you that reaction because it's a random thing to say. But number two, I think there could be some meaning there. We just have to think why you're looking for a key. What in your life, John, needs unlocking? What are you searching for? What's the hidden treasure chest that you're looking for? That you're looking for this key to open? What is it? Let's analyze. What is it? What do you think you're missing in your life?
Maybe I'm just looking for the key to the kingdom of the ring.
Maybe. I don't know. But I'd love to hear more of these clues. Do you dream? Do you remember your dreams?
No, I don't often dream. Do you?
Well, I think we all dream. We just don't remember.
Remember them?
Yeah. I never remember my dreams.
I remember when I was a kid, there were times I would have like a great dream and I'd get annoyed when I woke up because I was really enjoying my dream. Uh-huh. You ever have that?
Sometimes. But again, I never remember them, so I can't really. But what were some of your favorite dreams that you...
Oh, dude, I can't fucking remember. This is stupid. Do you feel that there comes a time where... I've always talked about how sleep... At its bare minimum, it's a waste of time. It's something...
No, it's not.
You enjoy it, but you cannot tell me it's not a waste of time.
I'm not saying it's enjoyable or not, but it's a basic human function that we need to survive.
Do you think it's out of the realm of possibility, though, within our lifetime, someone's going to come up with a way where when you go to sleep, you're able to control... Like, you could say, hey, I really want to marathon through True Detective.
Yeah.
And I'm going to program myself that when I go to sleep, I'm going to watch True Detective.
So that when you wake up, you'll have had the experience.
You've spent those 8 hours of sleeping watching something, doing something of a level of productivity. This is stuff I think about when I'm awake.
That's interesting, but not in our lifetime, because to do
how
anything...
How can you say that? If 15 years ago, you were to say half the shit that we can do now, it's crazy.
I just don't see it in our lifetime. I don't know what type of research is being done in those departments, but okay, maybe. I mean, what sort of productive thing would you like to do while in your sleep? What do you think we're capable of doing?
Well, if you're going with the basis that sleep is the equivalent of recharging yourself, your phone is at 5%, you need it to be recharged, mm-hmm. I'm fine with that. But I would just like to be – I don't really get a giant kick out of sleep.
You're not supposed to.
Well, you just said you...
I fucking love it because I feel good afterwards. I feel better after sleeping.
But would you not rather have that same recharge happen in an hour as opposed to having to spend 8 to recharge? That's a lot of time.
Yeah, maybe.
How often do you... how long do you typically sleep for?
It varies.
It varies?
I'm very spotty. But I'd say I try to get 7 hours.
How much did you sleep last night? Tuesday night to Wednesday?
Oh, man. last night, I woke up early today. I woke up at 7:30 today, which is early.
Wide awake?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Made myself some breakfast. It was nice. But
Do you always have breakfast?
No.
I never have breakfast.
Well,
it's not a good idea.
Well, that's another discussion we should be having. Yeah. But I probably got six.
We're not getting hours. The King of the Ring this week. By the way, we're just going.
Yeah. I got about six last night. Maybe that's why I'm so
six
tired.
Is good. I aim for 7. 7 is usually my goal.
Yeah,
for the longest time, I was having the most difficult time sleeping during the week when I tried to go to sleep at a reasonable hour, that being 11:30, something like that, because my hours are all out of whack from Friday night through Monday night.
Yeah,
it's always I'm up super late. So then on Tuesday and Wednesday are typically the nights that I try to go to sleep around 11:30, and it just doesn't happen. I just can't fall asleep. So now I've just decided I'm going to stay up late every night of the week, and I get most of my work done now from 11 o'clock onwards, and I go to sleep around 1, and I fall asleep instantly. Though if I'm trying to get up really early, that's a bit of a... I'm very tired in the morning, because I usually get up around 8 or so.
Mm, yeah.
But it works much better.
Yeah.
I have no problems falling asleep. I go until my...
That's pretty normal.
I'm falling asleep.
I feel like that's pretty normal for a lot of people. They don't sleep till 1 o'clock. And, I mean, that's how I've kind of been my whole life. I don't even have a bedtime. I just kind of go until I get tired.
I spent 4 hours last week one night going through our archives and fixing dead links.
Oh, wow. Thanks.
There's nothing more tedious than going through. It's not simply you upload a file, save. No, it's you've got to change the code. You've got to go to the old page that was posted in 2011. And our archives, admittedly, are just horrendous on our website.
No, but thanks for doing that.
Well, we're almost there. I've almost cleaned them all up. I'm hoping by the end of the week I get more done.
And what's amazing is that, I don't even know how many people will go back to listen to these things.
Oh, I know one will.
But as long as that one person...
Our man Brad, he's on top of it. Keeping me in my...
But as long as there's anybody who wants to, we want a good-looking, good-sounding archive. We want that.
I got a message, I think two over the last week or so, of people who are just... Hey, the June 20th, 2011 review of Raw link isn't working. I was like, who is going back and listening to our reviews of Raw from June 20th of 2011?
I've heard from people that have listened to every one of the reviews.
I can see Review Away having a lot of replay value, or just you've watched an event and you want to hear a reaction. I totally understand that. I think that's a fun little companion piece. But a random Raw episode, hey, I'm glad they do.
Maybe it was an event that they went to live.
Yeah, it could have been.
Or that they just remember very fondly.
We don't need reasons for people to check out our old library.
It's very much appreciated.
They're all up there.
Well, that's something certainly I think you can do while you're sleeping, just plow through our archive.
See, that's something I wish I could do. If I was asleep and I could mentally upload, do tedious tasks where I could be sleeping and recharging, but still doing
yeah,
something.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think it's
like a phone being plugged in, but it can still play a podcast for you as it's recharging.
Well,
it's
you
productive.
Should actually, I've had it happen where, you know, it's almost like a hypnosis, but I've had it happen where, like, I leave the radio on when I'm asleep, and then, like, I remember hearing that song in my dream, and then I wake up and the end of the song is playing.
I used to religiously listen to the Fan 590 when I was in high school, and I'd go to sleep listening to Storm and Norman Rumack, and my radio would just play all night.
Yep.
And then I'd wake up the next morning, I'd turn the radio off, and it one time happened to me where someone was having a conversation at school about something in sports, and I knew what the answer was, and I didn't know how I knew it. And I was like, because I must have heard it at some point overnight, and it just took up a portion of my memory bank, and it was there.
There you go. This technology already exists. So what are you going to do tonight? What are you going to listen to? How are you going to use up your be productive?
Now, I don't even own a radio, so I can't leave it on.
Okay,
overnight.
You don't need a radio. Now you have.
I can't sleep with headphones on either. That's just with something playing. That's not possible.
Well, then maybe you got to get your wife on this too. Hey, ask your wife if she wants to listen to Storm and Norman Rumack.
I don't think that's an option at this point in 2015.
It's on?
Storm and Norman? I don't think he's...
Whatever. Listen to the Wrestling Observer. Listen to The Law. Listen to What's Next. Listen to...
myself. I should listen to myself. That would be vain.
Yeah. That way you know what you're saying two times. You know it just twice as well.
I was, when I was editing the Michael Elgin interview, I had this, like, this is very rough edit because in the question I said right now twice. And I always think of you when I see that.
Why are you blaming me?
Because you made me aware of it.
It's not even me. It was members of the audience who pointed this out.
It's the most frustrating thing in the world. I don't know if I should just be.
You should just let it go. Because, I mean, I feel like for one thing, people miss it. You know, you don't do it as often.
You didn't.
Anymore.
You wanted me to let it go permanently and get rid of it.
I didn't. That was before it became a thing. I didn't realize how much I would miss it. And now that you don't do it,
I've just accepted
often,
my crutch term, and I'm going with it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
so
why not?
It's a subtle tribute to Van Halen.
Yeah, that's cool. Great.
My Fight Network radio days.
But do you notice other things that you say often? Is it just right now, or are there other things?
Oh, I'm sure there are other ones that people will point out once they hear this. You've really eliminated too much. In fact, I think Braden has picked that up from you, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you caught it from me.
Yeah. But I now notice it, like, I pay so much more attention to others. Right now is just, it's a goddamn, just rings
a
bell in my ear.
It's not a problem, you know, to say that. It's just, it can be a problem if it occurs too much within one sentence.
Well, right now, I don't know if I'm ever going to be eliminating right now. So for right now, people are just going to have to deal with the right now propensity, and the volume of right now is coming out of my mouth.
I don't mind it.
Vampiro's got one. He does, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
He does that one a lot.
Right. Who else?
I'm trying to think. I mean, for all the WWE each week, there aren't any that jump out at me for Michael Cole, other than like buzz terms that I feel are very much just indoctrinated his vocabulary to include WWE Universe and such like that. But in terms of just everyday speak, I don't notice it as much.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're also probably heavily critiqued with everything that they say and trained. So they probably got rid of any of those weird things.
Did you notice any with Macho Man Randy Savage in 1993?
Nothing that I noticed.
Well,
too much.
He was on this pay-per-view for 3 hours.
Yeah, he was.
You look back at 1993, and this was not a well-revered announce team. I mean, it was fine. But in 2015, I fucking love this commentary team.
Oh, so did I.
Dude, Jim Ross at this stage of his career, I mean, I think there's a real, just a sliding scale of how we rank wrestling commentary in today's day and age. If this was mediocre by 1993 standards, goddamn, this would be the best announced team it'd be among the top three, I would say, in wrestling.
Who considered this mediocre in 1993?
I mean, Randy Savage never really got favorable reviews.
Jim Ross, I think, was probably...
Jim Ross did, but he was also very new at this point to the WWF. He had just started at WrestleMania. I think he was still finding that chemistry with Bobby Heenan, and he's spoken about it years later, that him and Randy Savage were never really on the same page, at least at the start of their run. He was a very difficult person to kind of form that chemistry with. But I enjoyed these three on this broadcast.
So I mean,
it wasn't, you know, Bobby Heenan's greatest call. He's had some tremendous shows. But they were an enjoyable three-man team, which is a very tough dynamic to pull off in any sport.
Yeah, I thought that, you know, Jim Ross in particular, this was the Jim Ross that, you know, very much the 80s Jim Ross, very much the, you know, NWA Jim Ross, the one who would treat the matches like a real sport, much less about, you know, the Attitude Era type of stuff with a lot of theater and spectacle. This was the Jim Ross who was trying to turn every pro wrestling match in front of him into a legitimate sporting event.
And you could really see that contrast of Jim Ross calling Kurt Hennig and Bret Hart and then calling Hulk Hogan and Yokozuna.
Right.
It required a lot of, just different approach to both matches.
Yeah.
I mean, one in his wheelhouse and one that was very, very different from that.
But both good, you know. And I think Heenan, I really, you know, you hear a guy like him and you really do miss... Not just heel commentators, because those still exist to an extent, but like good, witty heel commentators and somebody who could argue in an entertaining way, in a way that still puts over the baby face. And I thought he did a lot of that on the show.
Well, today we're reviewing the first pay-per-view edition of The King of the Ring. This had been a concept that they had done at house shows over the years, and certainly there had been prior King of the Rings, but this was the year they increased from 4 to 5 pay-per-views on an annual basis, and the first one taking place from Dayton, Ohio, Sunday, June the 13th in 1993 at the Nutter Center.
Yeah.
The Nutter Center.
Nutter. Yeah. Is that some dude's name or something?
It was named after somebody.
Okay. That's kind of unfortunate. But you also, you know, we're going to the Nutter. Yo. Watching Nutters. I don't know.
The best part of this show was off the top. We got a crazy Vince McMahon introduction, which, if you weren't excited for a show, how do you not have a pulse? And it's just beating after you hear Vince McMahon welcoming you to the heartland of America, and that 8 of the top wrestlers will bang heads.
Welcome to the heartland of America, as the World Wrestling Federation presents the first ever King of the Ring extravaganza. Tonight, 8 of the toughest superstars of the WWF will bang heads in a grueling single elimination tournament to determine once and for all who is the King of the Ring. In opening round matchups, former WWF champion Hitman Bret Hart will square off against his old nemesis, Ruthless Razor Ramon. Pure perfection meets pure power as Mr. Perfect takes on the sinister Mr. Hughes. Hacksaw Jim Duggan will butt heads with a massive beast from the east, Bam Bam Bigelow. The undefeated Native American Tatanka grapples with the narcissist Lex Luger. Who will survive this grueling test of strength and endurance? Who will be crowned the WWF King of the Ring?
This is the most excitement anyone has ever infused when Curtis Hughes is among the 8 wrestlers that will quote-unquote bang heads.
I love Vince's read in the opening. You know, maybe because he doesn't do these anymore, hasn't done them in a long, long time, but I think he's great at them. You know, even if it was just like some random guy and not Vince McMahon and he sounded like this, I think it would be cool.
So the concept, as many of you are aware, an 8-man, one-night tournament to determine the King of the Ring, the announced team, Jim Ross, Bobby Heenan, and Randy Savage, and Heenan says that Crush, who will be challenging Shawn Michaels for the Intercontinental title, will be a Nutter victim for Shawn Michaels. Already a thumbs up for Bobby Heenan on this show. The King of the Ring tournament kicked off with Razor Ramon and Bret Hart in the quarterfinals. All first-round matches would have 15-minute time limits. And the crowd immediately started chanting 1-2-3 at Razor Ramon, coming off his loss to the I believe at this time, unnamed 1-2-3 kid on Raw. I think he was just...
What would they chant 1-2-3 then?
Well, that was the that would eventually turn into his name, but they all chanted it because he was pinned. 1-2-3, and that's how he was given the name. He was the Lightning Kid, he was then just the Kid, and then they settled on the 1-2-3 Kid, which, what a horrible name when you think about it. If you were just presented that without any kind of background, and you just think of, oh, the 1-2-3 Kid, god-awful name.
It's not that great. It's like being like, you're already being called a kid. Now you're also a guy who, you know, you'd assume just learned how to count. He knows how to count from 1-2-3.
It's one of those names too, where if you, it's like if you were in 1993, like there's some wrestlers who you don't know what the fuck to call them. If you're doing something like an interview with them, like how would you call him up? Would you just blatantly say, "Hey, Sean, I'm so and so from this outlet," or "Hey, kid"?
Yeah.
Hey, 1-2-3.
Hey, 1-2-3. Sometimes you see like CM Punk referred to in the media as, I don't even know what CM Punk likes to go by, but sometimes, especially like a lot of mainstream media that's talking about him, they'll call him CM.
Yeah, that's an awkward one. CM. Yeah. Like, call him Punk, call him... The guy has said he doesn't care what people call him.
Yeah.
But CM is an awkward one.
Or, like, when Samoa Joe came into our office one year, and one of our producers, who doesn't follow wrestling, called him Samoa. Right this way, Samoa. Like, that's... wrestling's weird. I mean, I don't even blame the guy, but, you know, like, it's... when you have people with, like... names like that, you don't know what to call them if you don't follow.
Hello, Samoa. So the match begins. Hart isolates the left arm early on. There's a very slow start as he's controlling Ramon. Savage is just throwing out soundbite after soundbite throughout the match. There's a hammerlock applied by Brett. Ramon then hits him with a knee to the back, sends him shoulder first into the post. The crowd is still berating him with 1-2-3 chants. There's a fallaway slam from Ramon. He's stomping down Hart, kicking him at the ribs, which would play into Hart, who was legitimately coming into the show with a knee injury. And then they'd do a story with his ribs being hurt as he would go throughout the tournament. Bobby Heenan, a man who has possessed many fantastic jokes on wrestling broadcasts. We may have been privy to the worst one he has ever uttered on a broadcast. He says, Razor Ramon is the type of guy that asks for a 1:23 a.m. wake-up call from his hotel.
He said it about Brett.
Oh. About Brett?
Yeah.
Because he says he jumps when he hears 1-2-3. I thought he was talking about Ramon. It wouldn't really make sense for Brett.
Well, he's talking about Brett because he kicks out. He was kicking out at the time.
Oh, I thought he was trying to play off the 1-2-3 chant. Okay. Well, either person...
He's saying like Brett instinctively kicks out whenever he hears 1-2-3.
Okay, well, this one was a swing and a miss. No.
But this is also funny because like Jim Ross and Macho Man would just deadpan him with these reactions and they just would not like... no fake laugh at all. Just like, shut the fuck up, Bobby.
Hart fights back. He hits a reverse atomic drop, gets a two count, goes into all of his comeback offense, side rush and leg sweep, elbow off the second turnbuckle. A bulldog is countered and Hart is sent chest first into the turnbuckle. Razor sets up for the Razor's Edge, but Hart counters, kicks off of the turnbuckle into a small package for a great near fall spot. And then Ramon goes for a back suplex off the top turnbuckle, but Hart counters it in midair, landing on top and pinning Razor at 10 minutes and 28 seconds.
I thought this was a really good opening match. You know, certainly nothing epic or, you know, long-lastingly memorable, but I thought it was a very good opener. I just personally have a real soft spot for this era, and especially Bret Hart in this era, where, you know, as a kid, I could watch these matches and just enjoy them, you know, because Bret was cool and he was the hero of the show. But watching as an adult, you really appreciate his wrestling ability and technique, and I thought here he carried Scott Hall to a very good match, and Scott Hall himself too, I thought played his role very well. He's just a guy who's full of charisma, his taunting in between a lot of his moves were great, so I really enjoyed the match.
Yeah, and this was their second pay-per-view match of the year. They also had a title match at the Royal Rumble. So Bret Hart advances in the tournament. Then they showed an angle from WWF Superstars that weekend, where Mr. Hughes attacked Paul Bearer and cracks The Undertaker with his own urn as Giant Gonzalez is involved and Harvey Whippleman is there, and they leave The Undertaker and Paul Bearer laying as Crazy Vince is selling this beatdown, and The Undertaker not part of the King of the Ring tournament.
Nope.
Mr. Hughes has the urn, and Whipple...
Do you think that they basically seem to have had to book very carefully, especially with their baby faces heading into a pay-per-view like this, because you can only have one winner coming out of this tournament, and therefore you couldn't, you know, you wouldn't want to job any of your actual baby faces, much like The Undertaker, like, I mean, not just even baby faces, but people like Lex Luger or Curtis Hughes, they couldn't really have them legitimately lose because they're all trying to be built up for something else. And so, yeah, that's just. I just wanted to say that that's one of the trickier aspects of booking a one night tournament like this.
Yeah, and this was actually, you know, by the time, you know, a notable angle doing something like laying out The Undertaker, but Curtis Hughes wouldn't last much longer after this. They never had a big match with Taker and Hughes, and Hughes was gone shortly after this, and we would get Undertaker and Giant Gonzalez at SummerSlam that year. They had two classics that year on pay-per-view. Well worth going out of your way to check out. So Hughes is, has the urn in the ring as they come back from showing the video clip, and Harvey Whippleman is alongside him, and Mr. Hughes wearing that hat that everyone's grandfather owned at some point in time in their history. And Mr. Hughes took on Mr. Perfect. Two misters.
Mm-hmm.
And...
yeah. Yeah, two misters.
Yeah, which would have given our former Fight Network producer a hell of a time. How would he address...
I don't know.
Hello, mister? Mister? Hello, Mr. Perfect? Perfect. Perfect comes out, and he does the behind-the-back towel toss that fucking lands perfectly on the shoulder of Mr. Hughes. Like, I rewound this and watched it. It was so precise. Like, right onto his left shoulder...
Incredible.
I mean, it wasn't just a gimmick.
No.
The gum, the towel throw. Wow. This also featured Bobby Heenan's brain scan, where he would draw diagrams on a still photo, and he decided to dissect the gum toss of Mr. Perfect to try and make a foul ball analogy. This was unfortunately another failure for Bobby Heenan on this show.
These were definitely awful. And I don't think the brain scan was ever good. The only good thing to come out of this, they're experimenting with like this telestrator technology. The only good was Jerry Lawler with the Magistrator.
Because he could draw.
He could actually draw. And like, the, you know, he'd make really funny things. Heenan just would just scribble. And the jokes wouldn't be there.
Hughes dives into this arm drag from Mr. Perfect, takes a drop kick from him, but Hughes is staying on his feet. Perfect then takes a punch and just flies over the top, selling for Mr. Hughes. Hughes has the advantage wearing his outfit that consisted of a tie, suspenders, and his shades, which also did not come off during this match. What attire for this man, who had numerous runs in the WWF over the years. He was one of those great mysteries of what people saw in this guy, who was, I mean, not a look that was so incredible that it necessitated just chance after chance. I mean, say what you will about Sid, guy looked incredible, and you understood why this guy just always got different opportunities. But Mr. Hughes, I mean, he got pretty consistent work throughout the 90s. He would come back later and was paired with Jericho briefly, yeah. Was paired with Hunter briefly before China. It's like they always saw something in this guy, and I don't know what the hell it was.
He looks like your stereotypical tough guy bodyguard, and I suppose anytime they needed somebody like that, you know, oh, who do we have that looks like he could fit this role? Mr. Hughes.
There's an Irish whip, and Perfect does this flip coming out of the corner. Brett appears on screen to give his thoughts about who he wants to face. He says Mr. Perfect has the endurance, but Mr. Hughes is a brawler. He would rather wrestle Mr. Perfect.
I love that. It's very simple. Keeps the whole tournament aspect in mind, and keeps in mind, you know, like what these guys are fighting for, who they have to face next.
Much more of a technical breakdown than we get from Bam Bam Bigelow a little later on in the show. There was this horrendous-looking spine buster where Hughes just fell over, and this just looked terrible. Perfect stood there as Hughes basically did a flip to simulate a hip toss. And then Hughes gets the urn out of the corner and just attacks Mr. Perfect for the DQ at 6:02. Not a very good match at all, and Perfect advances by DQ. So clearly they wanted to protect Hughes for this Undertaker program that they got very little out of. And this would be the final pay-per-view appearance from Mr. Hughes for quite some time, at least in the WWF. Gene Okerlund is with Mr. Fuji and Yokozuna. And how do they emphasize the evil Japanese heel, who's not even Japanese? They start it with a close-up of a Sony radio, and then they zoom out. Oh, Sony, those bastards.
I didn't even put that together.
Oh, God. This was awesome. They recount the WrestleMania title change with Hogan coming and taking the title from Yoko. Fuji says that Yoko had just won a hard 20-minute-plus match. Real time, 8:55. And referred to him a number of times as Yokozuma, which was not the official name that they were rebranding him. Were you a fan of Yokozuna at this time? Because he was one of my favorites as a kid.
Yeah. I hated him because I was a kid. So I fucking hated him. I hated his... Japanese guts, fake Japanese guts. But as an adult, I love him. He's in the, you know, when people talk about Rusev these days, a lot of comparisons are made to Umaga. But you can look at, you know, a character like Yokozuna, and it's that same kind of very gimmicky, almost cartoon like heel monster. But somebody who just like plays it so well, so intimidating in the ring. And, you know, especially in this guy's case, just he moves incredibly well for a guy that big.
What about Mr. Fuji?
He was great, too. He's so, I mean, you can't have, you know, if you had Yokozuna by himself, he wouldn't be able to talk. Otherwise, it would break the character. We heard him briefly speak.
You could argue Mr. Fuji couldn't do much better.
Well, at least Mr. Fuji has a legitimate Japanese-sounding accent. You know, Yokozuna here, this guy, we heard him briefly try to speak some broken English in what was supposed to be a fake Japanese accent, and it wasn't very good. It was passable. He doesn't look Japanese either, but like...
Well, he was born in San Francisco.
Well, whatever, but like, you know, like you see a big fat guy, and to 90% of the people watching, they don't know the difference.
Might be the first heel where they had a manager, and then they brought another manager on top of the first manager to do the promos, Jim Cornette.
I mean, it really kind of... There's no point for Mr. Fuji when Cornette got in. I don't know why, I kind of
liked that it was like this entourage he had around him. To me, it made him feel so important that he had all these advisors.
I really
like that year. Like, it was a low point for WWF, but I really enjoyed the heel Yokozuna champion as a child.
Yeah. I mean, I think Fuji here just adds a lot to the whole package, you know? You can't really sell the evil foreigner from Japan without having a Japanese manager, I don't think. And I think if Fuji's also not the best promo, but, like, I think I just – the two of them together I thought were great.
Bam Bam Bigelow and Jim Duggan were our next King of the Ring quarterfinal matchup. Duggan has moved over from the trunks to a singlet with the American flag on it. And Duggan takes him off his feet after three clotheslines. The crowd is very much behind Duggan. They trade blows. Bigelow misses a splash in the corner. And then Bigelow blocks a body slam, and Duggan is selling his ribs. There's a bear hug applied to Duggan and then stomps down on Duggan. Scoop slam, and then Duggan bites Bigelow, hits a scoop slam, misses a clothesline from the three-point stance, running into the corner, and Bigelow hits the top rope headbutt for the win. They went 5 minutes, and that was all they needed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember why Hacksaw was even a part of this at the time, because even at this time, he seemed incredibly out of place amongst some of the characters on this program, especially in this tournament. You know, Hacksaw himself is just, especially his selling, it's just so hokey, you know, like, he'll be in a bear hug and then he'll raise his arms like he's celebrating. Like, and that would be his way to, like, try to get the crowd going. It just, you compare him to, like, you know, a guy like Brett, or even a guy like Bam Bam, who is also a big guy, but
his wrestling just looks much more realistic. Duggan, on the other hand, very much like the 80s style, very cartoonish, very big and very lumbering, and I think at this point seemed very outdated in the ring.
They would already do this great angle. I think it was right after this on Superstars where he was out to be the first man to take Yokozuna off his feet, and it ended with Yokozuna delivering this bonsai drop on him, and he would bleed. He was bleeding from the mouth.
Yeah.
It was great. And when he came back, he was super over from that. This guy that had just been mauled. But, and it, to me, it got the bonsai drop over forever after that because of what he did to Jim Duggan. Oh, boy, this was why I'm glad we got to review the version on the network, because it included the Coliseum home video exclusives from Terry Taylor, who introduced himself, "I'm Terry Taylor." This guy was just so goofy, like the most ridiculous backstage interviewer, and I don't have any recollection of this guy ever doing backstage interviews.
"I'm Terry Taylor, and I'm in the locker room. We're with the Smoking Guns and the Steiner Brothers. Only on Coliseum Video will you get this interview exclusively. Now listen, Billy, you're going to go against Money Incorporated and the Head Shrinkers in an eight-man tag. You guys got to be the underdogs because the pressure's on your first King of the Ring tournament. How do you feel?"
"That's true, Mr. Taylor. The pressure is on because this could be like a mini battle royal. You're talking eight guys in the ring at the same time. Could happen. But I can't think anybody I'd rather have on my team than my brother Bart and the Steiner Brothers."
"That's a good point. You guys have worked on that revolver, your finishing maneuver. Do you think that'll be the key to victory?"
"No, we've worked on it hard, and we feel if we hit it on anybody, that it'll beat anybody in the World Wrestling Federation."
"Well, Scotty Steiner, you guys have been chasing Money Incorporated for quite a while now. Do you think the Frankensteiner will be the key to victory?"
"Well, you know, Terry Taylor, nobody's gotten up with the Frankensteiner. If I hit any of those four guys with the Frankensteiner tonight, we'll win the match."
"That's a good point, too. Well, Dogface..."
"Yeah, you know, come down to the dog pile, because we're going to be a bunch of crazy dogs in the ring.
You got it here in the locker room, everybody. They're excited. Let's throw it to the ring."
He's with the Steiners and the Smoking Guns for what might quite possibly be one of the worst backstage interview segments I can recall. We had Billy Gunn with not an ounce of personality in 1993.
Just a mustache.
He then interviews one of the Guns, and Taylor's reactions, "That's a good point. That's a good point, too." Rick Steiner was the only man in this entire segment with a pulse. It's gone.
Well, I mean, you realize this is just Coliseum home video, so none of these guys gave a shit, I don't think. You know, it's like, let's not put any effort into this. It's only for home video. But it was really interesting to see Scott Steiner here basically, you know, be the quiet, shy one amongst the two of them. Rick is the crazy loud one who cuts all the crazy promos. Here, Scott just sounds like a generic hockey player. Nothing about percentiles, nothing about math. He hasn't learned any of that stuff yet. This is just like a completely different Scott Steiner.
You show somebody a 1993 Scott Steiner, and then you show him a 2000 Scott Steiner. Like, you'd actually, if you're not a wrestling fan, you'd really need to do a double take to see that they're the same guy.
When I left, like, when I stopped watching wrestling for a time, and then I came back and, like, you know, he had become this big Papa Pump dude, I didn't recognize him. Completely different. Like, it was quite the major transformation, and you know, obviously much better for his career.
Lex Luger and Tatanka was the final quarterfinal matchup in the tournament in the opening round. This was pre All-American USA Lex Luger and the narcissist Lex Luger. Only gimmick I can ever recall as a kid that when it was debuted, I had to look up in the dictionary what narcissist means.
Oh, yeah, I probably never heard the word until
they originally just called him Narcissus before they just started adding the narcissist Lex Luger. But that was what Narcissus.
What,
like, horrible.
In wrestling, I understand that this is not, I mean, it's a very common type of character, you know, somebody who's in love with their body. But for somebody who, you know, came in with the cachet of a Lex Luger, I felt like it was a real kind of a waste to debut him like this. When you could have kind of done that All-American thing, you know, from the get-go if you wanted to.
Well, they had originally signed him, and he was there with the World Bodybuilding Federation, then came over to the wrestling side of things. And I think it was more just a reaction to when Hulk Hogan was leaving that we have to create our next big star, and that was where You know, they plopped Luger into essentially the exact same character that Hogan was playing with the whole American hero. So here he was still the heel against Tatanka. Luger has his mirror in the ring, and the referee wants his forearm to be padded because of his motorcycle injury, which required a plate to be placed into his arm.
Yeah, the bionic elbow.
Yes.
I love this. I love this gimmick. I mean, I think it's so... Does he actually have the thing in his arm? Does he actually have a plate?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, all the better, because, like, the way, like, the controversy of Rose, like, after his debut, you know, like, there were x-rays shown, and it became this big thing, like, wow, this guy, he's cheating. He's, like, you could foresee this being, like, an actual thing. Imagine, like, if, like, whatever, Floyd Mayweather all of a sudden had some injury, and he had to put in, like, metal screws in his hand.
Uh-huh.
And then this was discovered, you know, like, after this fight. He had metal screws placed in his hand. Wouldn't that be crazy? Anyway, it never happened in real life, but, like, I think in wrestling,
maybe this will
so
be
cool.
Jeff Hardy, he just had to have surgery for his broken leg and had a titanium rod put in. So maybe now when he delivers... You know, a leg drop. Maybe that'll be banned.
Wow.
He's in that rod.
But I think it's, you know, it's something so simple. And if anything, it's almost like taking a negative, you know, this guy's thing and turning it into a positive.
Tatanka charges the ring. The bell rings immediately. And he knocks the mirror over and onto Luger and starts chopping him. Bobby Heenan with just, I'll put it mildly, some offensive commentary towards Native Americans from the get-go.
Because he knows there's a 15-minute time limit, and he wants to keep that undefeated streak alive.
Yeah, but he don't understand what 15 minutes is. To him, that's a third of a moon. Many moon come, for I win match. You know, I'm here to understand.
He buried the elbow.
Hey, how are you? Hey, how are you?
Tatanka works on the arm of Luger. And then Bigelow shows up with his thoughts on who he wants to face. And he keeps it short and sweet. I want to get my hands on the Indian. Lovely.
Yeah.
Very slow match. Luger gets the advantage. There's an elbow drop. Gets a two count. Then there was a rear chin lock by Luger as Tatanka is selling. Ross announces that 11 minutes has passed. And it was the most excited I got during this match, knowing that we only had four left to go. If ever there was an argument for working the legitimate time of a match, this was it. Because of all the opening matches that had to go the full 15, these were the two they chose to go the full time limit draw.
Yeah. That was really unfortunate. And they had to book that way, you know, for to protect both of them, I suppose. But to have Lex...
Well, Tatanka was still undefeated at this point. Yeah. So they didn't want to end his streak, but... Bigelow was going to the finals.
But to have Lex Luger be the one to basically lead, you know, the heat here for a good 10 minutes of this 15-minute match is not fun to watch.
The best part of this match was discussing, you know, the opening round. There's a 15-minute time limit, and Savage is asked what kind of pressure that puts on you knowing the 15 minutes. And Savage says... I was never in a situation like this where time was a factor in a tournament, just completely erasing WrestleMania 4, one of his career highlights where he had to go through an identical style of tournament where it was four matches in one night, all with time limits on them. But who cares?
He doesn't remember
the
last year. I
God,
bet.
That was only 5 years before this. The bell rings at the time limit. Both are eliminated, so Bigelow advances to the finals. Luger wants five more minutes, and the crowd cheers. But then he takes out Tatanka with the loaded arm, which is unpadded, and Tatanka is knocked unconscious.
Yeah, the match sucked, but I thought Lex's arm gimmick was awesome. And this match, the last 15 minutes really... Sorry, the last 5 minutes, it was all Jim Ross, man.
Like, he
Jim
Ross was so good.
Working his ass off trying to turn this pretty boring match into, like, something that... Like, he was trying to really sell the time limit coming up really hard. And I thought they should have announced it in the audience, because they didn't announce it live, so that much of the people live in attendance didn't really see the drama leading up to the draw.
Jim Ross was... I mean, he took... bad matches and made them passable. I mean, he was just so fun to listen to on this broadcast.
You can kind of tell that, like, you know, even at this point, this was like his first pay-per-view, right? Or actually second after Mania. And so anytime, like, somebody starts a new job somewhere, you might get the sense that they want to, like, work a little harder just to, you know, because they have something to prove. And I definitely kind of got that sense from Jim Ross. Like, he was taking everything super seriously because he had a new audience to impress.
Okerlund is with Brett and Mr. Perfect backstage, and Okerlund just starts stirring shit right away, bringing up how Hart said he wanted to face Mr. Perfect instead of Mr. Hughes as if it's an easier match. And Brett pretty much just...
Mean Gene Helwani here.
Yeah, man, really just getting the grudge going here. And Brett says that Stu beat Larry Hennig, and Perfect denies this ever happened. And then Perfect says he remembers SummerSlam 1991. And then Perfect says he's a winner. And Hart just under his breath, you weren't at SummerSlam. And then Perfect takes his hand back after going to shake it and says, all you Canadians are alike. But never finishes the thought with any observation about how all of us Canadians are alike. Just all you Canadians are alike. Like, just something that if it was any other nationality would just be outright racist. All you Japanese are alike.
Well, then you're talking about race. You're talking about ethnicity versus nationality. Nationalities, I don't think, are it's not the same.
I'm saying Japanese, you're talking about people born in Japan. Canadians, you're talking about people that are born in Canada. It's a geographical isolation.
Okay, but when you're saying Japanese, you're also referring to an ethnicity, you know? If he said all you black people are the same, or all you white people are the same, that would be just as offensive.
Canadians are not simply one ethnicity.
No, but it's also not as personal, I don't think, to say, you know. Like, if
Why not?
Because you're not commenting on the way somebody looks. You're commenting on, I don't know, their upbringing. It's like saying, all you people from Toronto are the same. All you people from Montreal are the same. All you people from New York are the same.
All you people from Japan are the same.
Yeah, but all the people from Japan look one specific way.
I don't know.
It's like you're commenting on a skin color at that point.
I don't know. It's like you're a Canadian.
And I don't get offended when he says this.
No, I'm not
But if he said all you Chinese people are the same, yeah, that would be offensive.
Well, I was saying Japanese,
right.
Not Chinese.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I love this segment. I thought it was great.
I thought it was great, too. In 2 minutes, they basically had 2 minutes to sell a match that was just announced, and I thought they did a great job. Brett, again.
And a callback to a match that happened, like, almost 2 years before this, and I love that.
Yep, and also... you know, the stuff about my dad beat your dad. I think this match, like, you didn't even really have to sell. Like, you just put these two on the marquee and, like, I'm already interested. But, like, just this little interview makes you that much more excited that there might be some legitimate heat between these two.
You could almost make the argument this would have been a match to put in the opening round so you could actually advertise it ahead of time, because I think a lot of people held that SummerSlam match, and, you know, Perfect had been out for most of 92,
right?
And coming back, it was a cool little bonus you get if you got the pay-per-view where you get this. That was when we reviewed WrestleMania 4. That was one of the things, is like Savage and Steamboat could have their rematch in the second round. It never happened. And this one, it's like you got a nice little bonus in this rematch that was pretty well remembered from a year and a half prior to this. So that was our next match, the semifinals of the King of the Ring tournament. I believe we are now up to a 30-minute time limit for this. Ross observes that the fingers of Bret Hart are taped up, and I just thought Ross was so in his element calling the start of this match, just constant back and forth from the two, setting the pace.
Irish whip is reversed, far side, and the Hitman scoops up Mr. Perfect, and Perfect counters by kicking him away. Both men trying to go for a slam, but Perfect with the advantage. And again, the Hitman Hart kicking him away. Side headlock takeover. Oh, what an offensive exchange.
I love it. Unbelievable.
What a great match.
Heenan brings up the fact that he had to call that SummerSlam pay-per-view and couldn't be in Mr. Perfect's corner. This was at the time when he actually was managed by the coach, John Tolis. Anyway, there's a constant headlock takeovers applied by Bret Hart that just looked great. Perfect caught him with a knee to the body in the ropes, getting the advantage. They went to the floor. Perfect was definitely working as subtle or not so subtle heel in this match.
It would almost be gradual, you know, like as the match progressed, he would kind of define those lines a lot more.
Hart is sent crashing off the apron to the floor and immediately grabs his right knee and is selling the knee. There was a missile drop kick off the top by Mr. Perfect. Hart then gets his foot on the rope and then kicks out of a second pinfall attempt as Perfect is constantly getting frustrated. Hart kicks out and goes for a figure four, applying it, but Perfect makes his way to the ropes. Perfect applied a sleeper and held on until the count of four and then reapplied it, and Hart would run Perfect's head into the turnbuckle, breaking the sleeper hold. Hart hit this huge right European uppercut and then tossed Perfect into the corner where he crotched himself, falling in. And then constant pin attempts, went for the sharpshooter. Perfect grabs the injured fingers of Brett and stomps them. The best heel tactic of this entire show. Stomping a man's broken fingers. The Perfect Plex gets blocked. There's a vertical suplex that sends both over the top to the floor. They come back in. Hart reverses a small package, catching Mr. Perfect and pinning him. 18 minutes, 58 seconds, and Perfect is just pissed after this match.
Really, really good match. You know, it's almost the match that I feel like history would remember better if this was the finals. And I think this might have even worked better as the final match between these two, because you could legitimately see both guys as this King of the Ring. But I suppose they wanted heel babyface in the end. But for two babyfaces in the middle of this King of the Ring tournament, I thought this match was the best match of the show.
Yeah. Definitely. I won't put it at the level of their SummerSlam match, but certainly the strongest on this show. Okerlund's with Hogan and Jimmy Hart. It's zoomed in on Hart's jacket. It says there is no water around them in Dayton, Ohio, and no sneak attacks. What a veiled Pearl Harbor reference. Can't turn your back on those Japanese and their sneak attacks, but thank God we're not near any water. Hart uses lyrics from the future WCW song stating that Hulk, he's got the red, white, and blue running through his veins, and he was born and raised in the U.S. of A. American-made. And the largest guns are going to destroy Yokozuna.
This is like just, you know, another very stereotypical Hulk Hogan promo where he's talking...
Stereotypical period.
Where he just... Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, I would attribute... the popularity of that type of promo largely to people like him, right? You know, and he just talks in such grand terms, and you see him here, and much like Hacksaw, it kind of feels outdated, the style of promo, because you have guys like Brett, who was also on top, who just basically, in the previous thing that he was doing with Perfect, it was just didn't really feel like a guy performing as much as did just the guy talking like he was a real athlete. And Hogan, in contrast, I think they both have their own charms, you know? I think Hogan delivering a promo like this is really cool, and it's only something that, you know, you can only get from Hulk Hogan. But I have to say that even this feels outdated in a 1993 setting.
1993 was not that long ago, but you watch this.
It was a long time ago.
It's in terms of just modern thinking, I just think here we are. It's like... The heroic American fighting off the Japanese heel who, with Pearl Harbor references.
We have Rusev, man. We still that stuff always works. We had Muhammad Hassan. All this stuff it'll always work.
I would say Muhammad Hassan. It was dealing with much more contemporary world issues than. Okay. Pearl Harbor, which we were at this point over 40 years removed from. Hulk Hogan and Yoko's
they're making cars. You know, they're taking all the car industry.
Fucking Sony, man.
Yeah,
like those bastards. Hogan and Yokozuna for the WWF title in the middle of the show. If this was not telegraphing a sad finish for those youngsters out there, I don't know what to tell you. Ross notes that we have a large amount of photographers ringside, including many from the Orient.
They had like a crew of like 10 Japanese photographers following Yokozuna, and I thought it was a great touch. I guarantee you probably none of those guys, except maybe Jimmy Suzuki, is probably the only one who had actual film in their cameras, but it looked great.
Yeah, do you think all these photographers, did they have to submit their work after King of the Ring? Where did this access, what coverage did we get for this?
I don't know how many magazines there were.
There is a big reaction for Hulk Hogan coming out. Heenan says this is where you make the money, and you know you've made it. Above the NFL, Major League Baseball, and the NBA. This is it. Dayton, Ohio, the King of the Ring pay-per-view. Early strikes from Yokozuna. Hogan would sell. I mean, very slow match. And quite the contrast coming off of Bret and Mr. Perfect right before them. Hogan would bite Yokozuna, which I guess for the All-American babyfaces, Duggan and Hogan, I mean, biting was not...
You got to do
they
what you got to do.
They weren't above that kind of thing.
This is war.
And these are these World evil War foreigners.
II. World War II here. You can do a bit of biting.
Hulk Hogan, after selling, comes back with, quote, All-American right hands, according to Jim Ross. They have their own passports.
Yeah, in Japan they use the left.
those crafty left southpaws. Hogan hits a clothesline, gets cut off on the third. Hogan gets dropped. Yoko misses a splash on the mat. Bear hug by Yokozuna. Crowd is into it, though, as Hogan's trying to break himself free.
Well, listen, like, this is a Hulk Hogan match, and it's much like Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. If you go into a Hulk Hogan match expecting a technical marvel, you're not watching the right type of match. You're watching this match for the wrong reasons.
The fake Hulk Hogan in the front row, who would go all over the place, just getting the fans and trying to get them to all cheer as he's on his feet. One of the more famous fans at the time, the fake Hulk Hogan
guy. He looks just like the huckster that would be in those billionaire Ted skits.
Yes, yeah, very much so. Do you know that Brock Lesnar guy is applying for Tough Enough?
Wow, I don't think they'll choose him, but
I watched this video, and it was, man... You got to be aware when you're shooting outside of the wind.
It is not good.
It's the wind was brutal.
I thought we talked about this.
Oh yeah, I brought that up on Monday.
Yeah.
What'd you think of those videos?
Some were good. Some were ridiculous. But
for those
fun.
Of you that missed Review Raw on Monday, each week leading up to Tough Enough, we're going to pick a couple, and they are going to get the official Review Away endorsement.
Yeah.
We are going to be endorsing certain candidates for Tough Enough.
So,
giving them a national outlet.
So you'll be Kevin Dunn, and I'll be the Ken Mock.
Yeah, you'll be Ken Mock, and I'll be seeking out the next Kurt Angle each week.
Yeah.
So Hogan punches his way out of the bear hug. He's selling the lower back, runs into a reverse elbow from Yoko, who then hits a belly-to-belly suplex. Hulk Hogan kicks out and starts hulking up. He's delivering punches. He delivers three big boots, with the third one finally taking Yoko down. And then there's a leg drop. Yoko kicks out. He knocks Mr. Fuji off the apron. He calls for the body slam. Just had the crowd in the palm of his hand. And as Wei said, you could say whatever you want about this guy. He had a tremendous reaction from this crowd.
And, you know, you like, we always wonder why, oh man, why doesn't the WWE just hire, like, really good technical wrestlers? Why don't they just have a whole full roster full of really good technical wrestlers? I mean, I think on some level, stuff like this it might be even more difficult to teach, to find in somebody than how to, you know, do a great drop kick or something like that. Like, Hulk Hogan, he's just really great at being charismatic, and these two people are not, like, great technical wrestlers, but the charisma that they each have, and I think the characters themselves and the feud that they have, it was enough, you know, it was more than enough to get a great reaction from this audience.
So he sets up for the scoop slam when a photographer jumps up onto the apron, and he kicks Jimmy Hardaway on the floor. And Hulk is very distraught by this. He walks over to the photographer, and the camera proceeds to explode into the face of Hogan, who goes down and takes a leg drop, no less, from Yokozuna. And Yoko pins Hulk Hogan at 13 minutes, 11 seconds, with Hogan selling that he's blind. And Heenan, with the line of the night, says the bright lights of the WWF are too much for Hulk Hogan.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I've ever enjoyed a flash paper finish, like, in wrestling ever, but I like this a lot. I actually like this match a lot. I like this finish a lot. And, you know, what you're not looking for hyper-realistic fighting when you're watching a match like this. You're looking for storytelling. You're looking for fantasy. You're looking for theatrics and surprise. And I think this match provided all of those things, including that finish.
Yeah. Afterwards, Yoko attacked him, hit a bonsai drop as Heenan proclaimed Hulkamania is dead. This was about as definitive of a just destruction of Hulk Hogan that the WWF ever presented. And the way this was done, I have to imagine that they were clearly planning a rematch between these two, because this was so set up for Hogan to come back for revenge, and this would end up being his last televised appearance with the company.
It's much like that Brock Lesnar match, actually, which he...
you're right, in 2002.
I assume that Hogan was doing all this just to set up a comeback. You know,
That was supposed to be Survivor Series later that year, and Hogan wanted to beat Lesnar. They said no, so he didn't come back. But that was the other one where they did a huge angle with Lesnar murdering him, and with the idea of Hogan coming back. And I don't doubt that Hogan in his mind believed he was coming back to beat Yokozuna.
Yeah. But, I mean, I like this match a lot, but largely because it was Hogan cleanly putting over Yokozuna. Yokozuna here kicked out of the leg drop, not even at two, at like 1.5 he kicked out of the leg drop. And I thought he was so great, man. Like, just this big fat guy. And, you know, like, I think Hogan, he's great at playing the underdog against the larger opponent. And this match really reminded me of, you know, the Andre match. Except Yokozuna being a much more, a younger, more agile, more athletic version of, you know, 1987's Andre the Giant.
Yeah. There was a lot of discussion at the time for SummerSlam. I mean, Bret Hart has talked about it extensively that, you know, originally it was going to be Bret and Hogan for the title at SummerSlam, to the point they even did a photo shoot for SummerSlam prior to Hogan losing the title here, where they were doing a tug of war with the title, and, you know, allegedly Hogan didn't want to drop the title to Bret.
How do you think that would have played out in terms of, like, crowd reaction?
Hogan and Bret?
Yeah. I feel like you could have had, like, an Austin Rock thing right there. Like situation where, like, people like Bret, but, like, I don't know if, like, he has the star power of Hulk Hogan.
I think it would have been one of Hogan's best matches of that time period. I think for sure. I don't know. Say what you will about Lex Luger, but that build up to what ended up being the main event of SummerSlam of Yokozuna and Lex Luger. I mean, that was a pretty big build they attached with Lex Luger. And, you know, after this show, it was, you know, Hogan did a few more live events and then that was it. And he disappeared, and he wouldn't be back until 2002. So this would end up being his last appearance on television for the company for the next 9 years at that time. And they would go with Yokozuna. He would hold the title till WrestleMania of the following year, one of the longer title runs of the 90s.
When Hogan gets taken out here, they like cut to all these cutaways of these kids in the crowd.
There's nothing better when they do these cutaways to kids.
So good.
The concerned looks on these children. And, you know, so often they say that, you know, you don't want to send the crowd home unhappy. And I've always disagreed with that idea. If the ultimate, to me, it's like you have to take people down in order for them to get the payoff down the road. And this idea that we don't want to do anything that's, it's going to upset people. It's like, man, it's like the guy that does beat Yokozuna makes it that much more impactful. And
I
want to take people on that roller coaster.
Wrestling is weird because, like, in any sort of any sort of TV drama, like Daredevil, for instance, there are episodes where the bad guy comes out on top. Whatever, Empire Strikes Back, the bad guy comes out on top to end the show so that you want to come back and see Return of the Jedi. In pro wrestling, though, I think that it's a combination of TV show and live sporting event. And I think that philosophy is caters more towards the live sporting event aspect of it.
I don't think that, you know, storytelling in wrestling, it's the same formula as like a match. You have the shine, then you have the heat, and then eventually you have the comeback and the triumph at the end of it. And you can tell that over a prolonged period of time. And I thought, you know, this was a really effective way to, if you were going with Yokozuna, to...
So why don't you think they ended the show with this? I mean, for that reason, I suppose.
Oh, I absolutely think they didn't want to go off with this. You know, you were giving people the big babyface win at the end of the night.
Right.
I understand that, but I mean, I'm just talking about angles like this in general, where it was so definitive in the side of the heel here. I mean, right. There was no Hogan making a comeback after the match, getting his big, you know, even body slam for redemption. It's like they probably in their head were planning all of that for an eventual rematch here. I can't imagine Hogan signing off on this, knowing he was leaving the company, not getting anything in return here.
And what did you think of Jim Ross in this match, like in contrast to the other matches? You were mentioning how like he was calling this match kind of differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just, you know, what he had to call here. I mean, I think he really shines when you have two great, you know, a technical match such as Hart and Hennig that you didn't have here. This required a lot more on the storytelling side of things and getting Yokozuna across as this monster with the babyface and Hulk Hogan. It's just different. I'm not saying like better or worse, just a different call that when you have a match like this. So after this dreaded death of Hulkamania, we followed it up with Terry Taylor with Mr. Perfect. He asks how Mr. Perfect feels, and Perfect is clearly annoyed by the question, puts over Brett for his win, says he hurt his back and fingers, and essentially tells Coliseum Video to fuck off, and he walks away.
Yeah, I got the sense it was one of those two. Like, am I making more money because of this?
For Christ's sake.
I'm not putting in anywhere.
What's my cut of the Coliseum Home Video sales, Terry Taylor? Okerlund is with Shawn Michaels and Diesel, who had just debuted for the company a week ago.
Yeah, he didn't even have his name.
No, this was, to my recollection, the first announcement of his name. He says that lightning struck once to Hulk Hogan, but doesn't affect Michaels. He says Hogan is not the caliber of performer that Shawn Michaels is. Hulk Hogan is a dinosaur, planting those seeds for SummerSlam 12 years away. And
I wonder how Hogan would have felt if he, like, at the time hearing this.
Yes, yeah. I mean. For those that might not know the story, when Hogan and Michaels had their infamous SummerSlam match, which you go back and watch, is just, it's comedic to watch Shawn Michaels' performance. But then the next night, Michaels just like buried this guy in their promo on Raw. And it was something Hogan has always held against this guy for just being so unprofessional the next night of just burying him here. And here was a little precursor to that, maybe. No program going on here at all.
No,
Shawn Michaels and Hulk Hogan.
It felt a little out of place. I mean, not that much because, you know, Shawn's a heel. But, yeah, just to call a guy old on the show, I felt probably wasn't happy about that.
Gene Okerlund asks Michaels, what is this guy's name? And he replies, his name is my insurance policy, which I don't know if quite had the ring. New champion, my insurance policy. Wouldn't put the buy them. You name an IRS or like
Geico.
And then reveals his actual name of Diesel, and then clarifies as in diesel fuel for a Mack truck. Mm-hmm. That should have been his tagline.
Yeah,
for the back of the shirt.
Yeah, I mean, I loved just seeing these two together in this era. Shawn, Diesel. Biggest mullets on both men could imagine. Shawn holding his IC title with the white leather folded up, long earrings, chewing gum, and Diesel just with the Ray-Bans standing in the back and not saying a word. Like, to me, this is how these
grabbing
two exist.
Grabbing his fist.
Yeah. And, man, this is... Diesel definitely looked a lot cooler in black. Not so much the white, whatever, like...
Still the remnants of Vinny Vegas.
Yeah, white, bejeweled... jacket.
Dude, 1993 and what it contributed to the fashion was just incredible. We had an 8-man tag that was next to break up some of the tournament matches. Money Incorporated and the Hedge Shrinkers taking on the Steiner Brothers and the Smoking Guns. Featuring the Smoking Guns, often forgotten entrance where they came in with guns and then they shot the guns off into the crowd. If I had never seen this team and I was in the arena, I fucking would have been ducking under my seat out of fear that these guys were shooting fucking bullets in an enclosed arena. Holy fuck.
Yeah, that is crazy.
We're going to give you guns. I can see you're going to fire them because you're the Smoking Guns.
I imagine they could have a cop character today doing the same thing for controversy.
So, Money Incorporated are the tag team champions, and they would have a very busy next couple of days because there would be three tag title changes over the next 6 days, ending with the Steiner brothers as two-time champions by the end of the following week.
Why?
Hot potato titles. I don't know. They were doing a lot of title changes here. There was a pair of clotheslines by Scott sending DiBiase to the floor. Fatu hit Bart with a kick to the face as Heenan starts making fun of the Smoking Guns for going to rodeo school. The heels work on Bart in their corner, eventually makes the tag to Billy. DiBiase catches Billy, drops him throat first on the top rope, and then applies the million-dollar dream, but he releases the hold, and then Billy counters a scoop slam and wins with an inside cradle in 7 minutes. Then they all brawl after the match, and Savage says, "That's what you get for being an idiot," in regards to DiBiase giving up on the million-dollar dream before Billy Gunn submitted. And we had a somber mood afterwards with Ross and Savage still lamenting Hulk Hogan's title loss as Bobby Heenan laughed. Not really much to this eight-man tag. Time filler.
Time filler. You know, maybe just a way to calm you down before the rest of the card.
Gene Okerlund is with Yokozuna and Mr. Fuji and Jack Tunney making one of his rare appearances on camera with some ceremonial Japanese-inspired music playing in the background. I guess on that Sony radio that they had.
That's what they listen to.
Of course.
Backstage.
Fuji proclaims that Hulkamania is dead. He laughs at the idea that a piece of Americana has died. And he says, "All Japan celebrates." Which I can't really imagine Giant Baba and company just sitting back watching the King of the Ring pay-per-view. He says, with this win, they will have a celebration coming soon in America, which would be the big challenge on the USS Intrepid, where they would challenge anyone to body slam Yokozuna. And then they give an update that there's no permanent vision damage to Hulk Hogan, at least until he got into WCW with Creative Ideas. And merely had bruised ribs. Savage says Hogan won't let Yokozuna get away with this, and he will be right back and in Yokozuna's face, which would in fact be a lie. He would let him get away with this and never confront him ever again.
Who did they reveal the photographer?
Nope, they never did.
Just a random guy.
Just a guy. Shawn Michaels and Crush for the Intercontinental Championship. Another challenging name to speak to outside of the wrestling content. Hello, Crush, right over here.
Yeah.
Michaels,
your Crush's accountant.
Crush's the what?
Crush's accountant.
Oh boy, crushing those numbers. Michaels had won the Intercontinental title a week prior from Marty Jannetty with the help of Diesel. What about Michaels and his mesh? I don't want to say shirt. It was
like
this
chainmail. Like this, yeah.
This was like a rope mesh around him. It was some horrendous choices here. You mentioned the mullets of Shawn Michaels and Diesel, but this had to be a first because we had Shawn Michaels, Diesel, Crush, and the referee with four obscene mullets.
Mm-hmm.
It's all I could focus on during this match.
Yeah, and even like at the time, I mean, you don't notice it. I didn't even realize what they were. It was just long hair at the time.
With nothing on the side.
Yeah.
It's enough that you could hide it with a baseball cap.
Mm-hmm.
Michaels bumps off of a shoulder block from Crush, just flips and bumps all over the place for Crush. Crush lands a pair of drop kicks, and Michaels goes to the floor. Then Crush military presses Michaels. Savage says that Crush could slam Yokozuna, and he mentioned this repeatedly. The fact that Crush was one of the guys that they kind of had the idea of really pushing as a top babyface, but would never really get that push, and they'd actually turn him later in the year. That and Savage constantly using the term "shucka bra" in reference to Crush.
Mm-hmm.
Michaels goes to the floor, Diesel distracts Crush, and Michaels sends him into the post. Diesel cheap shots Crush, and then Michaels takes Crush's head and just repeatedly smashes the back of his head into the post. This was like Kingpin-level violence.
Yeah.
Smashing a guy's head into a post. Crush, of course, recovers from this concussion-induced smashing and tosses Michaels onto the ropes and then into the floor. Savage is putting over Crush as championship material. This was less than subtle. Crush is on offense, hits a big boot, clotheslines Michaels to the floor, and then Doink and his stunt double come down with Doink smoking a cigar, and Doink and his stunt double distract Crush, allowing Michaels to super kick him from behind and pins Crush at 11:15. Some things just never change, Way. The good old distraction finish featuring performers with just the attention span of a fucking ant.
And stunt doubles.
And stunt doubles.
Yeah.
So Crush immediately pops up and chases both Doinks to the back, and Savage is livid as Michaels retains the Intercontinental title.
Yeah.
Lovely.
I was really tired by this point watching the show, so...
Oh, this was a... I definitely
was losing steam.
Well, we have one match to go, Way. Let's find out who is the King of the Ring. Okerlund interviews Bigelow, an angry promo about winning the King of the Ring. And then Bam Bam comes out to take on Bret Hart. 60-minute time limit, but as Ross notes, we only have 25 minutes of satellite time left, so we hope we can bring you this entire match. Nice call to at least an attention to detail here on Jim Ross's part. We might not deliver what we've advertised, folks, but we'll do our best. So the match begins with with Bigelow having the advantage right away, overpowering Bret, and Savage gives this just gem of an observation as Hart is press slammed to the floor. He says, "It's over. I mean, it's not over, but it's over." Whatever that means. Translate that from Savage speak. Hart fights back. He's immediately Irish whipped into the corner. He goes down. The bear hug by Bigelow. On the floor, Hart reverses an Irish whip, sending Bigelow into the barricade, and then attacks Bigelow for his first series of offense. Luna Vachon comes down to the ring with a chair and hits Hart from behind, with the referee distracted. Ross is so disappointed that this is how the match is going to end. And then Bigelow climbs to the top rope. He connects with the headbutt, and he pins Bret Hart at 9.5 minutes. And everyone thinks, oh, Christ, what a fucking night for babyfaces. But Earl Hebner runs in, telling referee Joey Morella about the chair shot. And Finkel announces that the match is just going to continue. What a double standard.
Yeah,
when Curtis Hughes attacked Mr. Perfect with the urn, match didn't continue. It was a DQ.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, we get the match continuing.
Well, there's just simply no precedent set for, you know, a referee in the back seeing something occurring and then coming out to change the opinion of the referee that's actually in the ring.
How about at WrestleMania 4, an event that Savage has just conveniently forgot, where the final match, it's Hulk Hogan who runs in and hits Ted DiBiase with a chair, leading to the finish.
Bullshit.
So that match probably should have continued.
Mm-hmm.
DiBiase could have been the WWF champion that night under these liberal interpretations of the rules.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this the Dusty finisher was entirely necessary, you know, or if it really added all that much. But
the match continues, and Bigelow misses a senton to Hart. Hart then turns a backbreaker into a sleeper, but Bigelow tosses him off. Hart drop kicks him from behind, sending him to the floor, hits a plancha, is punching him on the floor, returns to the ring, and then there's a bulldog off the turnbuckle. Bigelow blocks the sharpshooter, and then Hart catches him with a boot in the corner, gets onto his shoulder, and applies a victory roll and pins Bigelow 18 minutes, 19 seconds, and Savage runs into the ring, showing no forms of objectivity as he celebrates with Bret as Ross puts over the big Bret Hart victory and Bret wins the King of the Ring.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like the match a lot. You know, this one...
You can say Bret was in the three best matches of the show.
Yeah, but the Hogan match I thought was great too, but for a different set of reasons. But this match really was just about that big monster, Bam Bam, who only had one match. He's still fresh and taking on the smaller, weaker babyface who's been through two very tough matches already, and this was just like basically Bret getting the shit beat out of him for the whole match. But I remember that victory roll finish very well, even from watching as a kid, because so often you just expect somebody to like hit their finisher, you know, you're waiting for the sharpshooter to end the match. But like, I think Brett was versatile enough and his wrestling looked good enough that, you know, he knew enough moves to be able to surprise you with a lot of different techniques. And this was like a move that I think was, to this day, is still very rarely used. But I thought it worked really well with his size, with Bam Bam, in the context of this match. So I thought a great performance by both him and Bam Bam.
Yeah, I always enjoyed the kind of unconventional finishes Hart would come up with, whether it was putting a guy in a sharpshooter from a different way, such as Yokozuna, where they play the size into things, or just winning out of nowhere with certain stuff like this. And this would actually play into the Owen Hart match a year later, where Hart was going for the victory roll, right, and Owen blocked it and pinned Brett. So I always enjoyed little things like that, whether they were intentional or not. So Brett wins the King of the Ring, and this was always a show he was very proud of, because he had lost the title, and they had basically told him that, you know, we're going in this direction. And the King of the Ring was kind of this night where they were like going to just let him go out there, wrestle for 45 minutes, different style of matches with a Bigelow, a Perfect, and a Scott Hall, all very different performers. And he was always very proud of like the variety of matches he was able to showcase in one night.
He had three very good matches. This is definitely I'd definitely consider it one of the highlights of his, you know, career. Yeah.
Then they had the coronation ceremony with Gene Okerlund at the podium, and Jerry Lawler shows up, calls Brett a pretender to his throne, and that there's only one king in the WWF, but will allow Brett to be his prince if he kisses his feet. And Hart says Lawler didn't even have the guts to enter the tournament, and says there's only one thing you are the king of, and you are the Burger King.
Oh,
shit is on, son. And they start a Burger King chant, which I would not be able to stomach if that was a chant in today's environment. Lawler then attacks Brett with the scepter, drops the throne onto Brett's back, and attacks his ribs, which was a nice tie-in to the injuries he had been selling throughout the night.
This throne didn't look light.
This looked like a fucking heavy-ass throne.
Dropped the thing right on his lower back.
Fuck, man. And then kicks him off the stage. And the visual of Brett falling down the steps to the floor, awesome. And Ross just says, this is terrible, to end the show. And set up, which would be a several-year feud between Brett and Lawler. And you have to imagine at this time, they at least either thought that Yoko and Hogan would be the SummerSlam main event, because it was clear that Brett was being programmed with Jerry Lawler for SummerSlam based on this angle.
I always found it odd, though, that they chose Jerry Lawler, who was an inactive wrestler at the time, when you had, you know, a lot of people that I felt... You expect that one of the top babyfaces to go up against one of the top heels, and I don't know if Lawler was one of those guys at this point. But that said, I mean, I think the attack was done really well here. You know, at the end of the show, I think Lawler just had great intensity, and I'll say his motivation was a little lacking. You know, why is he attacking this guy? Oh, because you're named King. Like, would he have done this to anybody?
I didn't mind it. I mean, this is a guy who, like, this is my title, and you're after it.
Then he should be mad at Jack Tunney. He should be mad at the people for
Well, he's a heel. He's not supposed to think rationally.
So if Bam Bam won, he would have done this too?
We'll never know, will we?
No, we don't.
Maybe Bigelow would have kissed his feet and been fine to be Prince Bigelow. This was a good show. Not a great show. But it had its moments, certainly, with, you know, the Brett was the star of this show for me.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, this is definitely the Bret Hart show. I like the show a lot. I mean, a lot of it, you know, due to nostalgia, but even just beyond that, I think you had three very good Bret matches. Hogan Yoko is a match that I enjoyed a lot as well. You had some filler on the show and some duds in the tournament itself, but it wasn't even that much. So compared to especially a lot of the pay-per-view offerings that we get today, I really do like the show, and I'll give it a 7.5 out of 10.
I'm gonna go 6.5 out of 10 myself. But we'll go to your feedback, see what you folks said about it. We start with Aram from Denmark. Just read the Bret Hart book the other day. Was there really talks of Hogan retaining the title and facing off with Bret at SummerSlam? And what a showcase it was for Bret Hart. His matches with Mr. Perfect still holds up. 7, Garov should be in Tough Enough out of 10. Yeah, that was certainly the direction that they were talking about. Hogan and Bret for the title at SummerSlam coming out of WrestleMania that year. That was, you know, Bret has maintained that that's what was discussed and even said, we did a photo shoot with both of us tugging at the title, which was going to be the SummerSlam poster. So Hogan has always kind of downplayed or denied it, and Bret's been the complete opposite and held that against Hogan, the fact that Hogan wouldn't put him over at SummerSlam, not believing that his size, it was credible for Hogan to drop the title to.
We go to Ronaldo from Milan. I remember being 13 and thinking the finish of the Hogan-Yoko match was weird. Maybe, if you think about it, the first BS finish in modern WWF history.
Not really.
Hogan looked amateur, out of shape, and unmotivated. Bret shined in the tourney and put on a spectacle few could follow in the years to come. 3 matches, 3 opponents, 3 different styles. The King of the Ring pay-per-view had its moments, but after 1995, it just became another show where the tournament itself was just a nice background for the world title angle of the month. Nice memories that need to be put to rest instead of digging up the corpse for the occasional WWE Network special of the week.
Yeah.
Why don't you think they've... Why do you think they've abandoned, you know, the King of the Ring as that type of setup? Who won? Barrett? I don't even know. He won the thing, right?
Well, he talked about it on Raw.
Oh, that's right. And do you think?
Do you think they'll even
mention it?
How
like past this month?
Well, I hope they do because there should be a reason to bring back these kinds of things. I didn't really see a reason for the King of the Ring other than it was an idea they came up with. I think at a time, a title or a tournament win, it's only as important as what the guy gets out of it. If it's something that's forgotten and never referenced again, then there's really nothing to it. It's the King of the Ring is not remembered for a guy that just simply wins a tournament. It's looked at as something that, okay, this guy is someone that we are serious about, and it catapults them to a main event scene. If it's just a secondary title with secondary performers that stay at a secondary level, that's how it's viewed by people. I mean, the Money in the Bank is important to people because they've set the precedent that it's the leap from a mid-card position to a main event position for the vast majority of the winners. But as a pay-per-view, it was always a pay-per-view that didn't always draw so well. That's why they added, they emphasized it with more title matches and kind of got away from an 8-man tournament. They would do a 4-man some years, then they'd go back and forth, and then ultimately dropped it after 2002. But now you're in an era where it's not so much drawing on pay-per-view as it is, you know, if it's a cool concept that you think people will be interested in, you can throw it on the network as a pay-per-view. People aren't picking and choosing pay-per-views. They subscribe, and I think it lends itself more to shows like this.
There's a lot, to me, there's just a lot more, like, I can pick out this pay-per-view out of, you know, Payback or Extreme Rules or whatever of what the fuck is the next one called? What's the one after this?
After Payback, there's Money in the Bank.
And then the one after that?
Battleground.
What the fuck is that? Like,
it's the ground they'll battle on.
It means nothing to me. These are just all generic shows. You give me one with a tournament. Oh, okay, that's the tournament one. I don't know.
Yes, this would be the precursor, though, in 93, to the UFC tournament that November.
This set that up.
Did you hear one of the stories this week that Hulk Hogan is one of his crazy claims now, which apparently Joe Rogan mentioned somewhere, is that the UFC... In 1993, asked Hulk Hogan to be in the tournament, and Campbell McLaren has now come out and said, that is absolutely not true. We never asked Hulk Hogan. Could you imagine
Hulk Hogan in that
UFC One tournament?
Hoist versus Hogan?
Yeah. Maybe that's why he wanted to leave after King of the Ring. He was getting had to learn his jiu-jitsu game and brush up on his boxing with George Foreman and Mr. T.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been a... Him and Art Jimerson. That would have been a hell of a with the one glove. Wow. And
actually, what was his name? The sumo wrestler.
Oh, with Tail of Thule?
Yeah. It would have been sort of a rematch of sorts with Yoko.
We continue on with Matt in Detroit. King of the Ring was an awesome concept back when the five pay-per-views had a different flavor to them. It was great watching superstars or Raw and seeing a handful of guys compete for spots while others were just placed in the tournament. And to top it off, Bret Hart main evented as a nice screw you to Hulk Hogan. The big shocking moment for me was seeing the Tatanka-Lex Luger match after seeing the SummerSlam 94 match last summer for a review. 10 new generations out of 10. A 10 out of 10 review for the King of the Ring. Wow.
We got a Chris in Ottawa. Hello again, gentlemen. Hope you're having a great spring.
It's just superb.
I was a pretty young, gullible kid in 1993, and I totally bought into the Lex Luger bionic forearm psychology. I loved it. A guy with a surgically implanted foreign object. Too cool. The semifinal match with Bret and Kurt is my favorite match the two ever had together. The pace, the selling, Jim Ross's call, and the cool, very real post-match handshake are all absolutely classic and will forever stand the test of time. And that WWF title match? Well, curse you, Harvey Whippleman. Oh, okay, was that who that was?
I think that's who played it, but played it was him. Never revealed as him.
I was an intense...
Actually, I don't even know if that's true, if it was Harvey Whippleman or not. Anyway.
I was an intense Hulkamaniac at the time, and I couldn't believe what had happened. I pored over WWF Magazine for weeks trying to define the identity of the evil photographer. Fortunately, before...
It was Bill Apter.
But fortunately, before it drove me to madness, the amazing bionic man became a good guy on the USS Intrepid, bashed Yoko with a steel arm, slammed him. Also, pretty hilarious that Crush hit a big boot followed by a leg drop against Shawn Michaels later on in the show, only to have Shawn kick out at two.
Ooh, subtlety. John Casey. Along with the graphics, Jim Ross made this King of the Ring tournament seem extremely important with his commentary. He got over how each match was important and made realistic comments, which is seriously lacking today. The ending with Lawler attacking Bret was brilliant, as it set up a feud, and Lawler's reasoning for the attack made sense. The IC title match and the eight-man tag was just filler. Surely having a Crush versus Doink blow-off match, considering their feud had been going on for months, and having the Steiners face Money Incorporated for the tag belts would have been better. I agree that the King of the Ring should come back as a network special, but only if it's given importance and it's a one-night, eight-man tournament, not just the semis and the finals.
John from Indianapolis. Don't have a whole lot to say, since all I've watched was Bret Hart winning the King of the Ring over Bam Bam. Is it true that Bret Hart was flatulent in the ring? I heard some stories about how he would let one out at the end of the match, with this one being a main example. We go to the expert, John. It was Bret Hart flatulent. Was he Bret Fart?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Very nice.
Okay, let's move on.
All right. Jonas from Hamilton. All right, he says, I never would have gone back and watched a show like this without Review Away, and I'm glad I did. Really great show. The Hart perfect match was easily the best match of the night. Hogan and Yokozuna was great. Would have liked to have seen Hogan lose clean, but a great example of immobile guys putting on an exciting match with great psychology. Big Show should be strapped to a chair and forced to watch this match. Clockwork Orange style. Luger is the clear Putski Award winner. Great show overall. Love JR. Macho Man was great too. 8 Japanese photographers out of 10. Hope to meet you guys at Global Wars. Yes, we will be there.
Brad from Whitby. So this was the last pay-per-view match for the greatest hero in the history of the planet, which is what me and Gene called him, actually. really a nothing match with the bullshit ending, but how fun was it seeing the distorted Hogan look alike at ringside after the loss. I think Hogan deserves his first Scott Putski Award for the show. After all, isn't that one of the reasons for leaving the WWF after his contract was up? Blah, 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 blah. I believe that the IC match was the greatest of all time. Greatest in terms of hairstyles. This was an epic mullet match.
Yeah, right down to the referee in that match.
Mm-hmm.
So some stylistic crimes committed in the Intercontinental title match. Is that it?
Yep.
All right. Well, King of the Ring 93, in the books. A lot of people had requested that one for us to check out. Had you ever watched that show before, or was this your first time watching it?
Yes, yeah, I saw it live, actually.
Live?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How do you even remember that? You would have been like 9.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness. Well, that was the King of the Ring 93. Now, next week, Way, I decided, recently the WWF uploaded all of the episodes of Raw from 1998. As I like to call it, Christmas. There is some great, horrendous stuff throughout the era that is 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought over the next 2 weeks, we could take a look at one of the great cliffhangers in WWF history, reviewing the August 3rd, 1998 edition of Raw is War, followed by the conclusion the following week on Raw. For those that forget, August the 3rd of 1998 featured an angle that us Canadians were kind of left out in the dark over. It involved...
It was cut out from the show.
It was, yes, we were left hanging.
It was chopped off.
It involved a new member of Kai and Tai. It involved a porn star. It involved a sword. And it involved John Wayne Bobbitt.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, Wei, next week we'll take a look at the August 3rd show and then the August 10th show to fully understand what was happening during the infamous choppy choppy your pee pee 2 week period.
Oh, I love that's what it's.
I think our show is kind of custom made for shows like this.
Yeah.
So both episodes are up on the WWE Network.
That's what we should just call the reviews. It should be the choppy choppy your pee pee.
Maybe
episodes of Bra.
Maybe we'll try and get Yamaguchi-san on the show.
John Wayne Bobbitt.
Sadly, I think we could probably get him on this show, and I don't think we really want to stoop to that level. I think we have a modicum of respectability. Maybe Dick Togo.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
You would have thought for the easy joke that it would have been him committing the act.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it was one of the least memorable angles in Val Venus's career. Maybe most memorable, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, I wonder.
He had many. I mean, that 98-99 period was... It was quite the time for one Sean Morley. So, August 3rd edition of Raw next week. It's a two-hour show, Wei. I am very much looking forward to watching a two-hour Raw.
Are we doing two episodes?
Do you want to do the two next week?
Or are we going to do a two-parter?
Originally, I was going to break it up, but...
Oh, okay.
What do you want to do? Should we self-contain this? Should we put two balls together and do one podcast?
I don't know if this has enough, you know...
There's not enough meat for 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know if the dick jokes could last for 2 weeks.
Do you want to just do them then next week?
We'll do both next week.
I feel you can't do one without the other.
No, it really has to be a set, I think. This is what you're going to get for 2 weeks if we do this for 2 weeks. So let's keep it contained in 1 week.
Put it this way. If we watch two Raws next week,
yeah,
it's still less time than we spend on one Raw
currently. That is true. You know, we'll do both of them.
Okay.
Next week,
August 3rd and August 10th, 1998, episodes of Raw.
Yeah.
A golden period for professional wrestling.
But with the main emphasis, obviously, on the angle. So.
Okay.
If we gloss over some of the less meaningful things, then don't blame us.
So catch the set next week.
Oh, God.
All right, that's it. I'm done.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know standing by. Bam Bam Bigelow, and Mr. Bigelow, I know you can hear me. Do you have a preference, sir, as to who you wrestle in the semifinals?
Well, we all know who I want. I want to get my hands on the Indian.